family-run music business called The Music Cellar, so a little shout-out to The Music Cellar. The couple that run this place, which started in their basement, hence the name, but long since outgrew their basement, one of the things I love about these folks is they just love to inspire young musicians. They don't just offer lessons. They bring in bands, they put on concerts, they bring in international caliber clinicians. They just do a whole bunch of stuff that they really wouldn't have to do, you know, because they think music is awesome and they want to inspire people to make music. In any case, about a year ago, one of the events that they put on was this concert. There's a quite excellent Journey cover band that's based out of Winnipeg. They don't all live here at this point in their careers, but they're based here. And so they had these folks come in and do a concert, and then afterwards they have this live Q&A with the band. And it's a pretty good-sized show. They drag in the PA and the lights, and they've got, like, I don't know, 350 kids there or whatever. So we're rocking it up to all these Journey tunes, and the kids are like, how come my dad knows all these songs? they have this Q&A with the kids afterwards. And in response to one of the questions about performance, the drummer, who's a pretty animated performer, made the point that we listen with our eyes. And he illustrated it. He's like, we'd just been watching this guy drum for an hour, and he's like, you know that shot at the end of this particular tune, you know, where I stand up at the end and behind the kit, and I'm like playing standing up? He's like, people think I'm playing louder when I do that, and I'm not. I'm not hitting anything any harder. People just think I'm hitting things harder because we listen with our eyes. It's a different kind of energy. Our sound, like pain and color and any number of other things, is made in our brain. It's a complicated matrix, right? Our brains are this complicated layered matrix. And even while neuroscience is increasingly able to identify which regions of the brain are primarily responsible for different functions, at the same time, one of the things that science is revealing is that almost all the significant functions that we undertake as humans happen in a bunch of different places at the same time in our brain, not just in one, hence hearing with our eyes. It strikes me as curious that we might regard all of what I've just been talking about as having nothing to do with prayer. Where do we think prayer happens? In us? And an answer like, in my heart, is interesting and entirely inadequate. It almost completely ignores the fact that when we pray, we do it as human beings. And that means that all the sorts of things that are going on when we solve a math problem or we organize our kids' schedule or we run an errand or we do strategic planning at work, all those kinds of things are also going on when we pray. We pray as whole people, just like we listen to music as whole people. And that's why we can talk about prayer in terms of body, mind, and spirit, or whatever designations or language we might choose to reference in an attempt to talk about what it means to be human. Prayer is not a superhuman endeavor that requires us to do something other than what we do as humans. That said, it's an endeavor that can carry us into realms of human experience we might not normally think about or be aware of, and so there's a both and. When I lead music in a religious or worship context, one of my favorite things to do is include songs that have vocalizing in them. And to be completely not technical, vocalizing is singing without words. So here, for instance, at the table, when we do Sufjan Stevens' version of Come Thou Fount, our musicians sometimes include his vocalized transition, that la-da-da-da, la-da-da-da, la-da-da-da-da-da-da, that thing. Should I just keep singing, or should I go back to talking, Steve? And we could listen to that little la-da-da-da, and we could think, well, that's pretty. You know, my two-year-old sings like that. Now, can we get back to the text? Like, can we get back to the words? Or we could stand back from it a little bit, and we could recognize that la-da-da-da as making space for one of the most common kinds of prayer. I think that this is probably the most universal way that we as humans pray. Urgent, spontaneous vocalization. Probably the most common one in our culture is, oh my God, right? Would it be fair to say that when that phrase is used in most of our prevailing cultural contexts, it isn't usually being spoken in a considered way? Would that be fair, do you think? It's not usually something we say while also being aware that the words themselves have meaning, like, why my God? You ever heard anybody blurt out in a moment of panic, oh, your God? Right? It just doesn't happen. It's, oh, my God. That would be arresting if that happened. It would be downright odd. Or we could just cut to the chase and talk about OMG, right? Which on paper looks more like an acronym for a brand name than it looks like a conscious attempt to reach out to the divine, you know? New this year from OMG, a kitchen appliance that will change your life and make you an unreasonably happy person, you know? Yeah, right? Which I noticed in the subtext this past week is oh my goodness, on the package, yeah. I know, interesting, eh? So, when I always thought it was oh my God too. And then I had a bag of it in front of me and I thought I should read this because I'm thinking about it, right? And I look at it and it says, oh my goodness. So when oh my God bursts out of our mouth, which in this case is sort of this portal for releasing into the world something that came from deep inside of ourselves, we may not be trying to say something with content any more than we are trying to say something with content when we spontaneously yell or spontaneously laugh or spontaneously scream. We might not be thinking about content. And yet, all of those things that I just mentioned, that scream, yell, pray, oh my God stuff, these are all ways that we pray. These are all human expressions of surges of emotion or sensations of awe or yearning or whatever that flood over us and connect to what I called last week the springs and the rhythms of life, that these things are all ways of connecting to mysteries that are too great for us to understand. So what la-da-da-da does in a song is make space for the most common kinds of prayer. The prayers that spring up without necessarily having clear speech connected to them, but that arise from some of the deepest places that we go. These prayers are often intensely personal, and if we were asked to explain what they meant, we might fail utterly. We might end up saying something like, I don't know, it was sort of overwhelming. I was so sad, happy, freaked out, angry, lost, fill in the blank. I didn't know what else to do. Right? I find it quite interesting that this space of I didn't know what else to do is so clearly described in Christianity's sacred text as a place where we intersect with the divine. That exactly this place of I don't know what to do with myself is a place where we meet God. And it's in the text. It's not sort of even vaguely in the text. When Paul's writing in Romans chapter 8, 26, he's writing about suffering and hope, and he's writing to people that know about suffering and about how hard it is to remain hopeful when you're suffering. And he's writing about how prayer fits with suffering and hope. And he writes this, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. That's super interesting to me. That's mysterious, right? If I think about our conversation here this morning and I think about what was going on inside of me during that conversation, I'm going to put this on you, Seema. I was ready to go over and join you in tearing apart some bookcases or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like this sense of, I don't know what to do with this. I need to do something with this. I need to do something with this emotion. I need to do something with this information. I need to... I don't know what to do. And that's me. That's us. That's, again, I don't want to put my experience on you. Having said that, that's me experiencing that emotion as a privileged person in the culture. I can go home and do nothing about this and not wonder if I'll eat tomorrow. It's a fairly luxurious position from which to be frustrated, relatively speaking. And yet, these were all things that were in my notes before we had this conversation. I hope they have enough range to embrace what we've been talking about here this morning. If they don't, let's talk about that. I know that one of the communities that our family spends a fair bit of time with are people that are new to Canada, and many of those people, as distinct from asylum seekers as you described them in particular in your work this morning, Seema, many of these people are people for whom their journey has taken them through a lot of countries and years in refugee camps, losses of an entire way of life, family connections, and all the stuff that we tend to place so much confidence in. I just finished reading the trilogy, the Breadwinner trilogy with Taya. I don't know how many of you are aware of that. Really rather fabulous account, fictionalized account of the suffering of children under the duresses of war. And at one point in the story, we were reading about this young girl. She's separated from her family. She's 14-year-old. Taya's 13. And she's basically making her own way on the streets of an Afghan city. And she gets arrested by the police for no particular reason. She gets framed, basically, and taken to prison, where she realizes, talking to the other children in prison, she will languish for the rest of her life. Like, there's no way out of this situation. And a white American family who had a couple of encounters with her because of one of the places where she was working on the street, trying to make a living, and they recognize her dog, and she's not there, and they chase it down, and they come and get her out of prison, and they take her to their home. He's an American engineer. He's in Pakistan, in this case, to build bridges, and so they live the life. They're, in his wife's words, his money goes a long ways here. And so they have all the things that, you know, most of us have, and they take this girl into their home, and she walks in, and there's a section in the story where she's just looking around the home and noticing, you know, the dishes and the cutlery and the food in the cupboards and the bedding on the beds and the garden in the courtyard. And then she realizes this is, and she has this conscious memory of having all those things as a child, in her words, before the bombing started. And I, Tam might have to work this out in therapy later, but I stopped reading, you know, and I was like, do you get it, babe? Okay, you know, this is our story. This is your story. This is how fragile the things are that we place our confidence in. Like, don't ignore that. Enjoy the things we have, yes. Share the things we have, yes. And don't pretend that they're a universal norm that is unassailable, because that's not wise. That's not true. So there's this mystery, right? If we talk with people from those stories about how hope continues to be alive, we're in pretty mysterious terrain. If we talk with some of our First Nations brothers and sisters about their childhood being snatched from them, along with the presence of family and language and culture and spirituality, if we talk with anyone who has suffered that kind of where did that come from encounter with the vicissitudes of life, with something that just left them dumbfounded and spinning, just like, what the WTF, right? What was that? And if you ask those people about hope, you are going to have, odds are, a very interesting conversation. I've often had the experience in conversations like this of being in awe of the ways that hope springs eternal. You know, the phrase itself is from Alexander Pope's An Essay on Man, and the stanza in which it sits says this: hope springs eternal in the human breast. Man never is, but always to be blessed. The soul, uneasy and confined from home, rests and expatiates in a life to come. Expatiates isn't a word we generally throw around in conversation. In the context of this little stanza, it suggests dwelling upon or focusing on something. So the soul, uneasy and confined from home, rests and dwells upon or focuses on a life to come. Now, for those of us that grew up religious, at least in the brand of religious that I grew up in, life to come might most easily suggest to us life after this life, which for lots of us, if we grew up in some of those religious settings, that can be just a shorthand for heaven, right? But I think that taking that shortcut of life to come equals life somewhere else, I think we potentially rip ourselves off if we do that. Because life to come, on the face of it, simply means what it says. It means the life that's still ahead of us. It means the life that's still to come. It means the next instant, the next moment, the next hour, the next day. It means life to come. What shall we do with the restlessness, with the longing, with the bafflement that emerges from deep inside of us in our inarticulate prayers, in our groanings. What do we do when, as the text we read from Romans says, when we don't know what we ought to pray for? An experience we may well have had in the last half an hour. To put it another way, what do we do when we can't see how to move forward? What do we do when we can't imagine what the future looks like? That can be a fairly ordinary experience as well as a traumatic one, right? I mean, what do we do with it? Well, Paul suggests that we trust God with that. Now, I think that is both recognizable as a very unsatisfactory Sunday school answer and as a profound mystery. Here's what I find most amazing about the thought that we can trust God when our words and ideas fail us. When we do this, when we choose to trust God in those moments where we're just like, I have no idea how to proceed with this, but what's going on inside of me sounds like, ah, right? When we choose to trust God in moments like that, we are not trusting God with those, I have no words for this prayers, so that God will make sense of them. The Spirit, Paul says, in those moments in our life, enters into that mystified, baffled, I have no words for this space with us. Completely different thing. The things that we have no words for, God or Spirit, in Paul's language in this case, does not turn into tidy, cogent thoughts, but enters into through wordless groans. Should I say it another way? When we have no words and the spontaneous things that surge up in us, which are prayers, come to be, what Paul is saying is not that God takes those prayers and makes them tidy, but that God is in them, that God enters the same space with us, that we are not alone in that space. Even at our most baffled, our most inarticulate, our most lost, we are not alone. God has not gone away or abandoned us or given us the cold shoulder in some cosmic act of passive-aggressive pique. Spirit, God, Paul reminds us, is right in the middle of that muddle with us. So listen, if what we are longing for is the presence of God with us when we are mystified beyond words, when we are baffled beyond the ability to articulate a cogent prayer, if what we are longing for in those moments of our life is the presence of God, all we have to do to qualify for the presence of God in those moments is be baffled. We're there. That's it. God, Paul says in this text, intercedes, gets right into the mess with us when we feel most weak and uncertain and stuck in mystery. Mystery can mean a lot of different things. Historically, what the church has often used the word holy for is what I'm using the word mystery for. I don't like the word holy very much, partly because it's a term that feels to me like it's been used a fair bit as a weapon. It's been a little too well defined and a little too aggressively applied in a few too many inquisitions for me to feel comfortable around it. It's too easily morphed into a boundary marker, right? Well, maybe not right. That's how I've experienced it. Mystery, though, mystery means that no matter how extensive our efforts, our insights, our discoveries, or our experiences might be, we will never, ever exhaust, eliminate, or domesticate whatever God is. We just are not going to get there. And it's interesting how in the Bible, the prophets give that mystery a name. The Hebrew people give that mystery a name. Jesus gives that mystery a name. And yet none of that naming resolves the mystery. None of that giving names to the experience of God domesticates God. All those names that I just talked about, all of them were different. They all moved the plot along. But none of them is the last word about God. And yet, intriguingly, the people having those cultural experiences where God was given a name and a certain identity and shape and description would have experienced that like we experience our God language. Like it actually did sum up God. So if you're ever wondering why it's so difficult to leave the tribe in terms of how you define God, if you're going through a shift with understanding how you define and experience God, and you're wondering why it's so damn much work, that's why. Because we all have the human experience of this definition is the definition. This is normal. That's why I stopped reading The Breadwinner to say what I said to Taya. Because we are so absorbed by our experiences that we think they actually sum something, that they actually take all the variables into account, and they never, ever do. Not least of all our experiences that have to do with God and language around God. So none of those names, the names the prophets give to God, the names the Hebrew people give to God, just in the Christian tradition, of course, the name that Jesus gives to God, none of those names and the ideas that they convey as language domesticate or sum God. The mystery of God transcends all, including any name or concept we might use for God. And the biblical story that comes to mind when I think about this, this is a personal fave. I know I've talked about this story before here, but I keep coming back to it because I realize there's so many different windows I can look in at it through. It's a personal favorite. The story about the woman that has been hemorrhaging for like 12 years, and she's determined that if she can just touch the hem of Jesus' robe, she's going to be healed, right? And as the story is told in the Bible, that's what happens. She works her way through the scrum surrounding Jesus. She tags his robe. She gets healed. And Jesus, in this story, seems a bit confused by the whole thing. It's a fascinating story to me because the people around him think he's actually joking when he says, "Who touched me?" The disciples, like the personal bodyguard, right? The people that are right in that inner physical circle are like, "You're kidding, right?" Because you're getting jostled like every second. What? Who touched me? For me, this is not a story to base some kind of theology of healing on. And not the least of the reasons for that is that it's told quite differently in the three Gospels where it occurs. And if you want to have an interesting experience with the nature of sacred text, just read Mark's rather novelistic telling of this story in which he doesn't just relay the events, which is Western readers we expect from a history. He tells us what the woman was thinking, and he tells us what she was feeling in her body in the moment when she touches the hem of Jesus' robe. Now, how might someone conveying history have access to that? It's a novel. It's a story. Did something happen 2,000 years ago in that crowd? We don't actually get access to that. The fact that it occurs in three storytellers' versions of the history of Jesus' life suggests that something happened, right? We can kind of say this with some confidence, like we can say that Shakespeare wrote the sonnets, but we could have a fist fight with the person who says Bacon wrote them. You know, somebody's going to disagree. It's a long time ago. That's interesting. It doesn't make the story something other than inspired and inspiring. It does make it something different than literal history. So we just need to pay attention. To be too literal in our reading of the story would be to fall prey to confusing the love letter with the lover, to borrow a turn of phrase. However, it's a very insightful story about this idea that the mystery of God is inexhaustible. And here's why I would say that. Our best shot at who God is or how connection with the divine works in this story can be deeply informed both by the perspective of the suffering character in the story, the woman with the hemorrhage, and by the perspective of the Jesus character, because the sufferer in this story has just the barest bones of an encounter with the power of the divine Like, it's a pencil sketch of an encounter. And it happens in a way in which it seems like the Jesus character in the story is both no more and no less than a conduit for the presence of the divine. She just brushes by God, and that's enough to bring healing. It's a glancing encounter with God. The Jesus character spends most of the story wondering what just happened. He says in one of the gospel accounts, some power went out of me, but he doesn't know how or to whom. He's a little baffled, a little at a loss. There's healing, and there's still plenty of mystery to go around. From a story like that, or perhaps from our own stories or the stories of those around us, we might be able to affirm that just a brush with God can absolutely alter the trajectory of our lives. But it is too much, it is way too much, to claim that that brush gives us more than the sketchiest of information about the wearer of the robe. And even such information as we do claim, we need to claim with enormous humility. Humility, fortunately, is, you know, the cousin of trust. And also, happily, if we can claim to have learned something in our brushes with God, that humility is about the mystery that God and our encounters with God can free us from, and I use this phrase very advisedly, even our most glancing encounters with God can free us from the imprisonment of certainty and usher us into the awesome space of possibility. Now, if you grew up being taught from before you were conscious of yourself that the business of religion is to inculcate certainty, this is going to be a hard idea. It's a deeply fused idea if you grew up in that environment. Very, very hard to approach. Takes some time. But if we stand back from the religious infusion experience in which ideas and faith get woven together so that they don't feel like they're separable, and we, as adults, we can separate them, but it takes some work, but we don't feel like we can. If we grew up there and we come to an idea like certainty could be imprisoning in terms of faith and encounters with God, sometimes we have to step back from religion and just use logic. I'm not saying religion is entirely illogical. I'm not trying to make a new binary. I'm contrasting the realms. If we step away from that fused, complex religious experience that we might have had as children and growing up in it, and we say, if I'm certain about something, do I have room for anything else? The logical answer is no. That's what certainty means. It means it can't be any other way. That's what the language conveys. So if we have spiritual certainty, how much room do we have for mystery? Well, not much. And yet, when we read a story like this in our sacred text, we find all the actors in the story going, huh? Not certain. Quite mystified. Who touched me? What just happened here? I felt some power go out of me. What just happened here? I brushed the hem of this rabbi's garment, and this physical ailment that I've been struggling with, that I've exhausted my savings trying to address, went away. What just happened here? That's an interesting space. That's a space that is full of possibilities, but it is not a space of certainty. It's not even a space in which the storytellers, committed as they are to making the point that Jesus is the temple of the divine, the carrier of God, which Paul goes on to say is all of us, intriguingly. But even in their determination to make that point in the story, they can't with integrity give Jesus the language of certainty. They can't do it. They refuse to do it in any case. And more than one of them had a shot at it in terms of the Gospels telling the story. But they don't do it. They just leave him kind of dumbfounded by the whole thing. His summary is, your faith has made you well. That's how he sums up what just happened. Does anybody looking for certainty find that helpful in terms of a new algorithm for knowing God and getting God to behave a certain way? You know, I don't think so. It's situations like this, the experiences of the mysterious ways that God responds to prayer, that free us to be imaginative and creative and untethered from the rules when it comes to how we think about prayer, when we think about what constitutes prayer, and as a result, that frees us from having to follow a set of rules when it comes to how we pray. We are even freed from the necessity of clarity of thought or the ability to give words to our prayers. None of these things are reinforced by this presence of mystery. We're freed from that. Our wordless groans, our brushes of the hem of the garment, are not just enough in some barely adequate way, but they are the stuff of genuine, authentic, as real as it gets, prayer. And so when Seema tells her story, and I'm sitting over there, and all I can do is go, it's not second best. That's not a second-rate prayer. That's the real thing. When we find ourselves in situations where we just, I have no words for this. I have no words for this is a prayer. And it's not a second-rate prayer. That's a prayer that comes from the deepest places that we live. It's a prayer that comes from the places where we find ourselves having the most authentic human experiences that we have. The idea that we have to tidy that up and turn it into a request for a vending machine divinity is absurd. We all live there, so I think I can say that, right? That's ridiculous. We all do it, and it's ridiculous. We can have tidy prayers. We can make thoughtful prayers. We can be as cogent as we wish. I don't think God suddenly goes, oh, that's not authentic. The process of the work we do is also authentic. This one, though, is easier to dismiss as inauthentic. And it needs a corrective. And I think that being aware of something like this just expands the reach of grace, right? Like, the reach of God's good presence in us, around us, moving through us. The idea that certainty is actually not helpful when it comes to spirituality, that it closes things in instead of opening things up, that idea can help us to sense grace in more places. It can help us to sense it in more personal places. It can help us to be aware of it in more societal places. It can help us be aware of it in more religious places, because some of us have also experienced religion as not particularly graceful. And we need to recover something there. We need to recover our ability to see the goodness of God wherever we can. And not being bound by a formula that says it has to be like, it has to look like this and behave like this, makes that space bigger. And that's a good thing. None of these ideas that I've been talking about, no human ideas are meant to encapsulate the grace of God. The good ones, though, extend it. They expand it. They make it bigger, not smaller. And all of this, you know, just from being willing to have a mystifying brush with the divine, just from being willing to be baffled and confounded and distressed and lost at sea. All that goodness just from that. I want to leave you with some song lyrics. This is a Norah Jones song that I can't seem to shake out of my head over the years. It's called Toes. The current is strong from what I've heard. It'll whisk you down the stream, but there never seems to be much time. And the refrain, my toes just touched the water. My toes just touched the water. Daydreamed on the bank again, I was swimming with the fish, and I thought this time it may be true, but my toes just touched the water. My toes just touched the water. Walked a mile just to find the edge, someplace low enough to step right in. Now I'm here and I can't begin to move. a spoiled son up over there. It always has to have its way, and I know that the river's there to shelter me, but my toes just touch the water. My toes just touch the water. If we think that it's our thoughts or ideas about God that have to be enough, we put the divine in a box the size of our best idea. I don't want to speak for your best ideas, but for me, that's not a very big box. And it just won't do. And the idea that the things that I experience that I have no words for might make that space for God bigger, to me that feels like a very hopeful idea. An idea that I can carry with me out of this place this morning and into the conversation afterward that Jason talked about, having the going back to the workplace on Monday. For me, a lot of times that's going back into conversations where there's no fixing what we're talking about. And carrying into those things the hope that springs eternal in the human breast that comes from reflecting on the life to come. From how could tomorrow be different than today? How am I going to act out the possibility of a universe in which just the brushing presence, the glancing presence of the divine can both bring healing and still leave all sorts of room for mystery, in which the things I can't even articulate become my most profound prayers. That's a space I want to try to live in.